This is the Aftermarket Radio Network.
Carm Capriotto, Remarkable Results Radio, and another Town Hall Academy mastermind. Thank you so much for being here. I so appreciate your support over all the years and the commitment that you've made to, you know, improve yourself and help us all together get some great information from all of our guests to help and not only advance you, your career, your business, but the aftermarket. Before I bring on my panel, thank you so much to our great sponsors, Napa Trax. You know, for over 30 years, Napa Trax has made selecting the right shop management system easy by offering the best, most comprehensive SMS in the industry. We'll prove to you that Trax is the single best shop management system in the business. Find Napa Trax on the web at NAPATRACS. And also, thanks to Coach Chris Cotton, you know, AutoFix Auto Shop Coaching will help your shop go from surviving to thriving. From financial insights to operational excellence, make your shop into a well-oiled machine. Find them on the web at autoshopcoaching.com. Here's my panel. I couldn't ask for anything better. Matt Fonslow, shop manager and technology specialist at Riverside Automotive, Red Wing, Minnesota, trainer and podcast host.
Luckily, we're supposed to be subject matter experts. The only subject I'm an expert at, though, is Scott Manna.
And Pollock's here, lead technology specialist at Wilco Auto Care, Sanborn and Lockport, New York. Hey, Brian. Good to have you here. I love that episode you and your wife did with Matt. Scott Manna, former shop owner, trainer, AC Delco technician of the millennial. Hi, Scott. I respect the ASC. I get what it does. We're not using it enough. But those questions that are created by these three people. And there's a ton of subject matter experts, SMEs, they're pretty much called. And I want to get just from their perspective and have the people in the industry realize that awful lot of work that goes into an ASE test question, right, Matt?
Well, not just by the subject matter experts, but by ASE themselves. You know, they have to organize the workshop, get individuals like Mr. Manna in there to help write quality questions that they can run through a process to determine how well of a job it does at discriminating between a knowledgeable test candidate and a less than knowledgeable test candidate. And I would say as it relates to a threshold set by industry. So, you know, this has been covered quite a bit, but it just seems like it's not covered enough or it's not being retained. ASE doesn't set the pass rate. They don't set the cut score. They don't do that themselves. They bring in a panel of representatives from the profession, both from the OE, independent, sometimes parts manufacturers. They determine what that pass rate or what that the passing score should be. They determine how difficult the exam should be, if you will. And then ASE, along with, I would say, help from ACT, determine how well that the individual question, as well as a collection of questions for the exam, how well they do at having the exam determine if you meet or exceed that threshold set by industry. And that's before the actual workshop, sitting down either online or in a room and coming up with a question, a single correct answer that would be technically called distractors that seem plausible to somebody that doesn't understand or isn't as knowledgeable about the system as they think they are, but absolutely wrong. When it comes down to it, that's where the struggle begins. And I talked so much that Carm just bailed. So I can't say I blame him. I'm a little upset, though. Some of the accolades he missed on Mr. Manna. Brian, did you know that Scott can pop a wheelie on a unicycle?
Oh, my gosh. No, he didn't know that because it's not...
It's true.
Factual. Too bad Carm's gone. He'd straight that out.
He said we're going on a path. But yeah, that's the struggle, right? It's not so much the question and an answer. A lot of people can do that, no problem, including everyone sitting in there. It's coming up with those three distractors that are absurd.
It's very difficult to come up with even just two answers or three that are, if you just don't know enough about the system, you'd be like, oh, this is simple. It's got to be that. It's very difficult to come up with answers that just aren't out in left field, because if you write a test and you have one correct answer and the three other ones are out in left field, well, it really doesn't matter what the passing score is. everybody's going to be able to pick that out. It was surprisingly difficult. I did my first one this past year, and it was way harder than I thought. And then coming up with data to support, you know, if you have to write a table or you have to make a diagram, or I think people would be surprised how much work goes into these test writing sessions, just making the diagrams. We went into the week and I think we had to come up with maybe like 4 questions or something like that per team or something. Gosh, it took some time. I was very surprised at how long between drawing diagrams, making sure the wording is just where nobody could argue it, making sure the answer is where nobody could argue it. I mean, I spent a lot of time in service information trying to argue that one of the other answers could be right to our own questions we were writing. You know, it was very eye-opening for how difficult that is to do. And then you think, oh my gosh, some of these tests have 60 questions on them. You know, they got to come up with, they got to do this for 60 questions. This is unreal. I think there's some people out there that have a skewed view of how the questions are written. They think that maybe they're all written by engineers, and there were engineers consulting on our teams. However, they certainly aren't written by all engineers. They're well over half of our team were technicians from the field.
Speaking as the elder statesman of the group, I got to tell you, you know, coming from a background of many years ago being a community college instructor, you know, part of that work was developing my own tests. I would write tests for stuff that I taught. When I started to do some aftermarket training, I was doing some ASE test prep training for Snap-on. You would always get these guys in there. You know, I did a lot of L1 test prep classes, and you would have guys, the common theme with the technicians was, who writes these questions? You know, like, you know, these are impossible. You know, they would say something like that, or these aren't right. And once you sit in a workshop, you get that behind the scenes look and you realize how skewed the test takers are and how wrong they are, and how well these questions are, how well they're made, how, you know, the thought that goes into them, the debate that goes into them as we go over the questions that we write and then flush them out to say, you know, is this going to move forward? They have no idea. So, you know, when Karim was talking about the inside look at this and how this works, most people really don't understand how good of a job ASE does in putting these tests together and making them a good test. Like, kind of like what you said at the beginning, Matt, of, you know, how well they do at finding out if you know what you need to know about a particular subject. And if you don't, they'll figure it out. They'll be able to figure it out with these questions. It really is an amazing process, a super interesting process. I enjoyed it.
They used to have a full, they might still. I thought that he left, his first name was Chuck. I have to think a while what his last name was, but he was a on-site full-time psychometrician who studies that. I mean, that's his field of study, is tests and exams, and to assure that the test is doing what they're saying it's doing, and the quality of the questions and the quality of the exams. And I don't know if they have the individual there anymore, but I'm sure they have psychometricians involved either with ASE or, they sublet it, if you will. Some of them, discussions with people that are taking issue with the questions and the exams themselves, it is like a walking, talking dictionary definition of Dunning-Kruger.
Yes.
Because they are so positive they are right. They understand the system, the question. This, you know, the answer is supposed to be A, but it could be B. No.
It's alarming.
It can't. It cannot be B, because if you read the question itself or you looked at the data, this eliminated that as a possibility. And man, they argue and argue and argue. It really goes nowhere. And it sucks because I don't know if it's a societal thing, like outside of auto repair even, or if it's just some pressure we've put on ourselves or management when they pay for us to take the exam, something like that. Maybe it's just intrinsic. We put this pressure on ourselves to pass. And if we don't pass and we get a question wrong, that we take it so hard. I don't know if there's repercussions back at work. I don't know if management starts coming down on us or something like that, because they could look at it as an educational opportunity. You know what I mean? Like, ASE is not going to spit out the questions they all got wrong. And they're certainly not giving you the answers. But the report will show you the areas of the exam. So every exam has its own, I don't know, it's not really a study guide, but a task list.
Yeah.
And that helps determine, helps you as a test taker determine how many questions are in this area, in this area, in this area. So, you know, if we're talking about engine performance, there might be one certain portion dedicated to fuel systems and computer systems and stuff like that.
Ignition, right? It's stolen. Yeah.
Exactly. And they tell you that. Well, when you're done, pass or fail, you can get a report that shows you in those areas what your score was. So did you get 6 out of 7? Did you get 9 out of 10? Did you get 4 out of 12? And you can say, wow, I got my butt kicked in the electrical portion. That is a good reason to take that and go, I need to get better. I need to take up some education somehow online, go to automotive seminars, watch some Thornton and Manna classes. I need to go to a trade or a training conference, take some electrical classes. I need to sit on YouTube, see if I can find some Scanner Danner videos or others to help me. I got to get signed up for my online training through, you know, whatever vendor, NAPA, of course, with their online training, and just get better at the electrical portion. Because then when I retake the exam a few years later, I can see, did I improve? And now I passed with flying colors, because now instead of getting 4 out of 12 on the electrical portion, I got 10 out of 12.
Wouldn't you guys agree that every test is an educational opportunity?
Absolutely.
Some of us would. I mean, I have to agree with Matt. I'll tell you what, if you want to be off social media for the day, just open up one of those pages that have to do with either the content or on the test or the content on the app, and just read people trying to tear the questions apart and realize, I'm like, oh my gosh, this, like, the explanation for why you got the question wrong was in the app. Yep. Like, we're literally writing the explanation. Hey, for example, you got this question wrong on diesel throttle bodies because they work opposite of gasoline throttle bodies, and they'll still sit there and argue and argue and argue, and like, well, that's not how that works, and I've been doing this for 200 years or whatever the magic yep. number is they've been doing it. And it's like, I'm sorry, guy, but this is how it actually works. This was, you know, vetted by engineers from 3 major manufacturers that build vehicles with diesel engines in the U.S. and other research from other manufacturers that weren't there, that we literally went and did. We could not find one that worked the way that you're saying they all work. I think as technicians, it's a pride thing, right? Because we're always right. Like, I've never made a mistake. I don't know about you guys. Like, I don't screw
up. I believe that, though.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
You and Scott, but, I guess. Yeah. But I'm not so sure.
I think that people are unwilling to check their pride at the door and use it as a training experience. They're so concerned on the pass or fail or the how many questions I'm getting right, as compared to judging their own knowledge and realizing, hey, I did really good here, but man, I didn't do really great there. Maybe I should do some reading. Maybe the next one of these that comes in, I should blow an extra 20 minutes and just fart around with this part of the system on the vehicle so I can get a real understanding for how this is actually working versus what I think.
Yeah, and consider the fact that you could have probably backed into the answer. Like, if you didn't know the way the throttle body, like the throttle position voltages are reported, mm-hmm. like you didn't know, you can still get there, because the other three you can disprove.
Yes.
Like, it can't be that. It Absolutely. Can't be that. And it can't be that. There's all that's
only one right answer.
Yeah. Even though I couldn't just read this question and just know the answer was D, I know it can't be A, it can't be B, and it can't be mm-hmm. C because of this data. Got to be D. And we fix cars that way. I don't know always for certain with this test that this component is bad, but I can back into it because I know it can't be this and it can't be that and it can't yep. be that.
Well, that's not accurate. You do always know, but anyway.
Yeah, every module you've ever condemned, every module you've ever condemned is because everything else is working.
Correct.
I think, Matt, you would agree that in the pre-COVID days when we got together for workshops, right? If the average test taker, and especially the test taker that there's always different kinds of people. There are people that are using this to better themselves. They want to learn. They will study up if they fail a test. And then there's the detractors that you were just talking about, Brian. But if the general group of people that take the test could actually sit in a workshop and watch it, or if one was filmed, they would understand how well the questions are written. And to what you're saying, Matt, about how it's been argued by 14 guys around a table as to why the right answer is the right answer, and the other three detractors are not the right one. Yeah. We've beat it up. You know, it's been beaten up. It's been discussed. It's been hammered around by a lot of really smart people. You know, so it's really amazing to sit in a workshop, to see the dynamics, to see how it goes, and to see what, you know, all of these different people bring to the table from, like you said, Brian, you know, OE guys, OE mm-hmm. trainers versus aftermarket guys versus, you know, all of that kind of stuff. One of the things that I thought would, you know, I was kind of interested in hearing, certainly from you two guys, is what makes a good SME? If you looked at what are the qualities of a subject matter expert, what are they? What's, you know, what is that? How does ASE decide?
Well, I would start out by just holding a mirror up in front of Scott Manna, and then that is
not going to work.
That is the definition right there. You know what, though? I think it's when the test manager or exam manager from ASE is putting together this workshop, it's like putting together a team. You could bring in a whole bunch of theory guys, the theory people, guys and gals. You could bring in a whole bunch of theory people. They know how this stuff works. And it could be a terrible exam or a terrible test question pool. Because you also need wordsmith. You need people that can read those questions themselves and do some tweaking with punctuation, different words, lower the reading level down. Even condense it down. It's like, hey, you know, this question is two paragraphs long. You don't even need that second paragraph. Everything you need is in that first paragraph. There's also people that they just have a really good way of coming up with the distractors. Like a lot of questions get written where, you know, you got the question, you got the answer, which is called a key. The key is the correct answer. And the person that wrote the question can really only come up with two decent distractors and just struggled to come up with the third. And you got people in the room, some of them just have a knack for it. So to me, it's like putting together a team. If you're putting together a basketball team, you wouldn't want all three-point shooters. You need people that can play some defense. You need somebody that can set picks. You need somebody that can rebound. You need somebody that can post up down low. You need somebody that can pass. You know, you're assembling all these skills to put together a really good team. So, you know, they bring in Scott Manna because he knows how stuff really works. And somebody writes a good question, but it's theoretically incorrect. Or one of the distractors could be a correct answer. He's the guy that calls that. Like, hey, whoa, think about this. Or here, I got some a case study, or I have some service information here that we got to change this distractor to make this completely wrong. And then, you know, I think same with Brian does the same. And I don't know why. I think they bring me in for comic relief. I am not really sure why I brought in, but
can I tell a story about a workshop? When I kind of think about, you know, what's like a perfect subject matter expert, I would say, first and foremost, you'd want to have somebody that has a formal education in automotive repair, you know, so that they have that theory box checked, as Matt's saying, you know, he didn't learn it his entire life just inside of a shop. And that's the way that shop did it. And that's his knowledge. He should have a good SME, should have, you know, some formal education from an accredited educational institute. But along with that, which a lot of times some of the, and I think Matt, you may agree with me, I don't know, or you may not, you know, that's certainly something that the OE, especially the OE training guys, they bring to the table, right?
Yeah.
They're very well educated, and they're well educated on their particular product. But the second thing you got to have is experience. Experience is required. If all of your knowledge is book knowledge, then there's a problem with that as an SME. And I'll give you a perfect example. My story is we were in a workshop. I was actually in a workshop together with Matt. And I'm pretty sure that Matt wrote a question. And it was a question related to, it was a question related to a drivability problem that would occur if excessive ethanol fuel was introduced into a vehicle. And as the question was read, as it was being, you know, we were going over our groups of questions, an OE gentleman, you know, really took exception to the question. And his kind of his, if I remember this right, kind of his beef was, we don't even have cars that are flex fuel cars, that are E85 cars. So my guys who are our dealership network would never get this right. And it was a perfect example of experience of saying, it doesn't matter whether you guys make flex fuel cars, and it doesn't matter if you teach flex fuel, that mechanic still could run into this problem. Experience would say, you know, you have to have experience to understand what might happen. So all of these things kind of wrap in when you're talking about it. Mm-hmm. So when you develop that team, as Matt said, when you bring in, and the guys at ASC do that, when they find the OE guys that they know are can cover the bases on their product, but then they bring in the aftermarket guys who have tremendous experience. And of course, last but not least, communication skills. You have to be able to communicate your ideas, both on paper, as well as probably in a room when you're debating these questions out.
Yep.
Those three kind of like key elements, I think, make a good SME. Certainly, I can tell you that most of the people that they brought to the table, they brought to a team, have all of that. But sometimes some of the aftermarket guys have more in the field experience because, you know, they're pulled right out of a shop. You know, they were working on a car yesterday. Sometimes when you get an OE guy who's maybe been in a training department for 15 years, he might not be working on cars regularly. He can demonstrate things on a brand new car, but is he seeing the failures that happen in the field? Nah, maybe, maybe not. So you got to have that mix. That mix is really critical, I think, to have a good test writing workshop take place. Agreed, Brian?
I agree 100%. You got to have those mixes, right? Like, I don't bring a lot of formal education into the mix, but I've been wrenching on stuff and fixing cars for a long time. And like you said, having the theory, having the engineering knowledge of the product is great for fixing a lot of things on maybe some newer vehicles, maybe something that hasn't seen a lot of wear and tear, but you need that field experience to understand when somebody says, well, this doesn't really happen on these vehicles. You got to say, oh, that actually does happen. We actually do see this in the field. I understand that you're not seeing it in your testing, but up here in Buffalo, New York, where they put down metric tons of salt on my street every winter, we are seeing failures in this department, and this is how they fail, and this is how it can affect the electrical system, so on and so forth. So yeah, there's definitely advantages. I think you nailed it. You have to have people with engineering experience, and you have to have people with field experience. And in our workshop, they had both. It was a really good mix of people with engineering experience and field experience, all in one group, all able to communicate well. And like you said, these questions get beat up hours at a time. These questions get beat up. That's what I think a lot of people don't realize that. I think that how they picture it is we all get together and we write this question and we agree that it's going to work in 5 minutes. And it's literally hours. 12 people will sit staring at each other, trying to disprove this question and say that it's broken before it even has a chance to get refined even further. As far as maybe drawings, punctuation, and wording by ASE themselves. The question gets beat up for hours in the rough draft stage.
I'm sure the workshops you've been in, the question get thrown out, right? Or we shelf that one.
100%.
You know, we have questions that can't be fixed. We're never going to get this right. You know, we can't fix this question. It's broken. Or we'll have a
really good key and some really good distractors, and we'll scrap the question and try to write a question to what we got sitting there instead. You know what I mean? You scrap the whole question. You scrap the stem, restart the stem, and get something that works for what you got with your answers. Because coming up with those answers, like Matt said, that's difficult. It is so hard to come up with three things that can trick somebody. I shouldn't say trick. I don't know if that's the right terminology.
They're going to feel tricked, but it's
they'll,
not.
They'll feel tricked. It's hard to come up with three answers that are plausible if the data or the question was asked a little bit different.
Yeah. Tricked is kind of just has this nefarious, you know, implication behind it. The reality is if you don't know, you're going to be tricked. That's just the stone cold reality. If you don't know, the idea isn't to take somebody that knows their stuff and trick them into getting the question wrong. It's trying to get somebody that doesn't know the system as well as we want them to or need to get this question correct, that the distractors, the wrong answers are so weak that you could get the right answer anyways because you don't need to know. You could figure out these are so bogus.
Right.
You know, the check engine light, did it come on because of the windshield or the tailpipe or something else absurd?
Don't say mirror.
Right. Then you don't need to know. But now if these are, you know, gosh, that check engine light came on because of these four things, but I have this data here. And if you're not good at interpreting the data, it seems like there's two possible answers or three possible answers or even four possible answers. Like these could all cause that. No, they can't. Only one. The history of ASE, has there been some questions where there were accidentally two possible answers? Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, there is a group of humans in there. You can have the human error element and timing stuff. Like, you know, when did the question go through? Was it at the very end? Everyone's exhausted because it's mentally exhausting.
Sure.
But it doesn't happen that often because of that big group and because they get reviewed and because the questions go unscored first. A question isn't written, doesn't get the seal of approval, and boom, it's on the exam and scored. It gets run through once or twice, and they see how it behaves. Right. And then it comes back to the group. If there flags an issue, it's like, wow, you know, we got a lot of people going to this answer and mm-hmm. this answer. And it's not just the weak test taker, or I don't want to say weak test takers, but the people that are scoring weak on the exam going after this. We also got some of their, you know, passers also going for this. And then we review it and go, oh, that's because that could be an answer. Or let's reword this a little bit. Or, you know what? Everybody that went for that, they just didn't know. The question's fine. And then it runs.
Let's face it. Your shop management system is the single most important tool in your shop, period. NapaTrax was built from the ground up to make your business more profitable and efficient. We provide an extensive set of tools to increase and track profitability in real time. NapaTrax offers the industry's best post-sale support, hands down, and we train your people on site. Yep, on site. And we offer remote refresher training 10 times a week, and customer support is open 6 days a week. Give us a call, visit the website, or join our Facebook community today to learn more. We'll prove to you that Trax is the single best shop management system in the business. NapaTrax is always customized and tailored for you, whether you're a one-man shop or a large multi-bay or multi-location company. After all, it's your shop, so it's your choice. Visit us on the web at NapaTrax, that's NapaTrax.com. To the dedicated auto shop owners, do you find uncashed checks gathering dust in your top drawer? Believe it or not, that's a sign that there's a better way to run your business. This is where AutoFix Auto Shop Coaching shifts the gear for you. It's not just about clearing that drawer, it's about redefining success and efficiency within your shop. With an AutoFix Auto Shop Coaching coach to hold you accountable, you're just not surviving, but thriving. Don't let the uncashed checks be your legacy. Visit AutoShopCoaching.com today. It's time to cash in on your true potential. AutoFix Auto Shop Coaching, turning potential into prosperity.
You know, I wonder, with an ASE person involved in your particular committee, your group, if they saw that the debate on the question was so, I don't want to use the word violent, but strong, they would maybe give that a rating. So when they put it out for test, they know that the team struggled over that question and see how it ranks.
If it gets to that, we might have to come back to it later. But if it really gets to that, they're going to be like, if this group of 15, 20 people, the best of the profession can offer, can't agree on this, how does the test exam, how does the test taker stand a chance? So it gets shelved, scrapped, whatever, and we move on.
Yep.
Because like Brian's kind of suggested, you can eat up a lot of time debating about this question, and it might be just wording. It might not even be fundamentally the question and the right answer and the wrong answers. It might be just tweaking it just right, wording it better. A lot of time gets spent on these each individual question. It's very rare one just blasts right through.
There's a lot of statistical checking in the background that ASE does that your average test taker would be astounded to see. I'm not sure how to explain it. Matt would do a better job. But remember how they would say, you know, oh, that question's going to blow a 5, but that one's going to be a 12, you know. They kind of know any particular question where that kind of fits in terms of difficulty. And as well as how well do you know the subject? You know, you can write, as an educator, you can decide what you want to do. You can write a question, you know, you can write a test that you are pretty sure everybody's going to pass. You know, you can make things really easy, or you can make things much more difficult. They have a really good handle on all of the questions as they go through the testing cycle. Either regular questions that are getting graded or these kind of stuck in there questions, kind of research questions. They have a really good handle on where these questions are at, and they have a room and they have all these questions indexed by tab, and on a test maker at ASC will kind of like put together a test. And they, by no means, are trying to put together a test that just knocks everybody out of the ballpark. You know, we're going to have the pass threshold so high that this guy's going to have 20 years of experience, and he's going to have a PhD in automotive to pass this test. They're not looking to do that. And they don't. I think they do a really good job for the most part.
They're going to track the question and make sure it does its job of differentiating between somebody that knows what they're, you know, is knowledgeable enough or not knowledgeable enough. And that's where we get this number 10, 12, 14, 7. And I think they're, on average, they're shooting for like 11.7. I think that's kind of the average. That's what they're shooting for. And then if a question is more difficult, it will be higher than the 11.7. I believe that comes from ACT. It's part of what a psychometrician would look like. That's what they calculate. And they're watching to see how the test takers in general answer it to determine difficulty.
For the first time in probably 8 years, I went to a bookstore last Sunday. Ann and I just went to walk the mall. There was a Borders. And I said, oh my God, I'm going to walk in there. Hopefully it won't crash down on me because I haven't been to a bookstore in so long. And I'm just looking around. I have to tell you, there were more people in there. I was surprised. There are 50 people in this Borders doing everything that you could imagine. Coffee shop, magazine racks, kids in there on this section, but a lot of adults looking at fiction and nonfiction. And as I walked the store out of my observation and curiosity, I came across this education section. And there had to be 100 titles from ACT. Knowing we were going to do this episode today, you find out inside of you how important ACT is to test scoring and education. Amazing.
So they're going to watch that difficulty. And I think they will not use a question. I don't think they'll use a question below like 8. Oh man, it might be 9. So in this rating, they're shooting for 11.7. If the difficulty of the question comes back as a 9 as a test question, you know, when they're the trial of that question, they won't use it. And then they won't use, I believe the highest they'll use off the cuff, I think, is 17. So the thing is like if they put a 17 on, they need to balance that out with a really weak question
with
so that
9.
They can average the, I think it's 11.7. And there's another number they look at. I could be wrong about the title, so forgive me if I'm wrong, but I think they call it a biserial, where they're watching how the test takers are. So you have four options, right? A, B, C, D. And they're watching who selects the correct answers. The correct answer is A. They want the majority of people that pass the exam to pick A because A is the correct answer. It's the key. But then they're going to watch the other three, and they would like to see them fairly evenly split up. That tells you you have three strong or at least equal distractors. Mm-hmm. Now, even though a question can do its job with, let's just say the key is A again, and then B is a very strong distractor, pulls a lot of people towards it, and then C and D are just weak. They're gimmies, like no way they could possibly hit. The question still does its job of differentiating between knowledgeable and less knowledgeable, but it's not preferred. They want to see a more even distribution with the distractors. Like Scott said, they're tracking everything with these questions.
Actively also.
Yes.
It's not like, okay, we run them for a while and then we see what they do and then we go do something about it. Especially with the app now, if they get a lot of negative feedback on a question, I had Leo contact me 2 Sundays ago in the morning. He goes, we're getting a lot of feedback on this question. What do you think? I loaded my stuff up and asked all my Facebook friends to see who had a certain model, year, make, model vehicle. And our county legislator had one, and I drove over there and I got some data off. And I said, no, Leo, I think the question is good. I think we just have a lot of people confused as to how this works. It's a very dynamic situation. I mean, these people are working daily, not just on new questions and assembling things and getting things, you know, scored with ACT and all that stuff, but they're working daily. If they're getting feedback through the app on questions, it's a daily occurrence. They're looking at these questions. They're saying, okay, did we mess up here? So it's not this thing where incorrect questions get written and they have to stay there, or even like they're like, well, it's on there now and it must be right. I mean, if they get a lot of feedback, they will absolutely go look at that question at 100%. I've been a part of going to look at that question to make sure that we are being accurate.
And I guess it's important to note, there is a difference in philosophy between the ASE renewal app and the exams. When you go take the paper and pencil, if you will, the CBT, the computer-based testing, when you go to the test facility and sit down, the job of that exam is to discriminate. That's this job. It's a test. You either pass or you fail. The renewal app, the philosophy is a little more about continued education. It's a renewal app. You've already passed the exams once. You have had to go to a test facility and pass the exam. So you've already met the cut once. Now, if you go to the renewal app, it's about continued education. And so there's a lot more leeway, if you will, with those questions that they can be very specific, car line specific, system specific. It's not really about differentiating between, do you know what the hell you're doing or not? It's, here's something new. Here's something you may have never seen. Here's a way to look at some data you may never have had to before.
Yeah.
And you can get the question wrong and it's not the end of the world. They're going to have follow-up questions that are kind of based off that first one that you may have got wrong. It's not about pass fail specifically. Yes, you have to get so many points to earn your credential. The philosophy, the driving force behind it is educate, 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 continue to educate you. It seems to be lost on 90% of the people that take the freaking renewal app because they treat it like, I got this question wrong. Now I'm not going to get my credential. Like, are you kidding me? And like Brian brought up earlier, the comments. I've been doing this for 40 years. I've never seen this before. Well, don't you think it's high time you did? What? Again, it's continued education. It's not discriminating. It's educating and trying to educate you.
Yep. In that app, when you answer the questions, whether you answer correctly or incorrectly, it lays all the answers out, the four choices you had, and it tells you why the one that you picked was correct or incorrect. It tells you why three are incorrect and the correct one is correct. It's not just like, oh, you got that wrong. See you in 3 days. We'll send you another question. Yeah, no,
exactly.
It sometimes tells you
links.
Yes, they will give you links to help educate yourself. This is why you got this question wrong. This is how the system works. This is why this can't be the answer. This is why this is the answer. And just like Matt says, I mean, they have links that go places for training and education to help you more understand that system. So when they send that follow-up question in a couple of days, maybe you've done some reading and studying up. I mean, they've laid it all out there in front of you. You just have to choose to read it instead of be offended that you got the question wrong.
Exactly.
We all heard the statement, you don't know what you don't know.
Right.
You know, and, you know, every test is an opportunity for education. How does a guy who's been wrenching for 28 years and who probably hasn't gone to any kind of a training class or a training conference for 10 years, because like Brian said, he's got the attitude, I've been doing this forever, I know. No, they don't know. The only way that they can figure out that they don't know is by taking a test, right? Or, you know, obviously they get their butt kicked in the bay on a car, you know, but unless they take a renewal test or unless they take one of these exams, they don't even have a chance to figure out that, oh my God, this kind of technology has showed up in the industry. Matt, how many times have we changed a composite vehicle for L1 testing?
Four.
You know, it has to keep getting changed because of all the things that get introduced into the automotive world, you know? So you're
going to get changed again here pretty soon.
It doesn't stop. And, it's only the chance of taking a test like this that gives a guy an opportunity to realize, I didn't realize I had fallen so far behind, you know, I didn't realize these cars, man, you step out of this industry for 3 years and it's like, whoo, you know, what happened?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I haven't seen any of this stuff. So
it's advancing on an exponential curve and turns out it's not all quadrajets and HEI anymore. You have to really pay attention. I do more reading now than when I was doing this for only 5 years because the technology advances so much. And then there's so much incorrect information out there. You know, you have to cross-check what you're reading across multiple sources if you're not understanding what you're seeing, so on and so forth. And people don't take the opportunity to educate themselves. And that's the major issue. And it's a culture thing in our industry, right? Because like you referenced, Scott, somebody, they don't find out about the technology until they get their butt kicked in the bay. But how many times is that guy making that excuse? Oh, well, that was because of XYZ. It's never because of this guy who didn't study up on the technology. It's always, I don't have the right this. I don't have the right that. This was broke because of this. This was broke because of that. It's never, hey, maybe I should have read up more on this. Maybe I need to really educate myself on how this works so this doesn't happen to me again.
Brian, I got to ask you to explain to the audience what a quadrajet is. That it has nothing to do with Boeing or anything like that.
A quadrajet, that's that thing that you take off and you put a holly on. That's how that works.
Some people never knew it as quadrajet. They called them quadrajunks.
Yeah, quadrajunks. Those were a little before my time, but I do a little bit of everything. I have a jet kit right in my toolbox. So
there you go.
We get into those every now and then.
Do you think we accomplished our goal of explaining to the industry, number one, the honor to be a subject matter expert, but the responsibility and why ASE is such a great organization because how much they care to get it right?
I'm worried that we're preaching to the choir, that most of the people listening to this already know.
Think of the people that haven't been SMEs, and maybe someday they would love to. Maybe they need to put their hand up and say, you know, I could do that. I'd love to do that.
The best people to get in there sometimes are the ones that complain the most. Have them sit in there and write a freaking question for a while. Or they write a question and then Scott Manna shreds it in front of them. Then it hits home like, this is hard.
Like one of them big wood chippers. He just tosses it right in there.
It's very hard.
Dude, it wasn't my first. It was probably my third. It was an L1. And it was in a hotel. Just by pure luck, I think it's luck, I get to sit next to Dave Scaler. You know, the first kind of round of stuff goes through and I'm like, wow, you know what? I think I can hang with these people. Ryan Koyman's in there. Jeff Masterman's in there. I would say some industry stalwarts. And I'm like, God, I'm kind of hanging with these guys. I'm feeling pretty good about myself. Then second batch of question writing. And I write a question that I think is so good and submit it. And I get a couple of thumbs up, feeling really good about it. Scaler destroys it. He has no ill intent. He's not going after me. He brings up a couple really good points about my question that just destroy it. And I go back to my room just thinking like, I'm not sure I belong here. I got to bring my A game. And it was a major, major wake up call. A, you do have to bring your A game. B, you think you know, you got a solid grasp of something until somebody brings up something that you didn't think of. And I mean, Dave Scaler is a freaking genius, is what I walk
away. One of my favorite test writing workshop attendees.
Dave, he was great.
Such an awesome perspective, and he can bring things down to the test writer. I mean, to the test taker level, really good. You know, he just got phenomenal insight sometimes and can, and like you said, he can look at a question and so that's okay, or no, that's got to go. Yeah. The same.
Multiple way. Test managers had said that he just has a knack for writing at that score, that cut score area. He just has a really, really good feeling about where that is. Just, he know the cut score is like what would be the threshold between knowledgeable and less knowledgeable. So he's good at writing a question at the proper level, not too hard, not too easy. He's got a really good knack for writing just like, right just there. Like
Goldilocks.
Yeah, he's not like me where you're writing stuff to just tick people off in the group. He's really good at just hitting right in the money, right where he needs to be. I tried to pattern myself after that, but it's a tough act to follow.
The reasons that I wanted to have this SME subject matter expert episode is I was a subject matter expert for ASE once. And that's where I felt like I wasn't even worthy to be there. And it was for the P2 part specialist. Now, there's three parts levels, P2, 4, and 1. I mean, I think it was a day and a half, 2 days. Everybody from the industry was represented there, the retailers and whatever. And I was pure wholesale person because I cared more, you know, the service specialist. And I'm arguing for the fact that we're not trying to sell batteries in the parking lot. And it's a completely different thing. So I kind of struggled with trying to get questions written that were not trying to get counter people to be repair specialists. But I admired the disciplines and the things that I learned. I wish I could have gone back to a second time because I think I would have been better. But God, it had to be 15 years ago. I never, ever forgot my experience being an SME for P2. That's why I wanted to have this. I adore ASE. I think there's going to be some fun things coming out since they're now 52 years old. They have a new president, Dave Johnson. Spent some time talking to him. Smart guy. He's got a great organization. They made some moves. I was at the doctor's yesterday, and this is just something crazy that I'm sitting in there in a waiting room. It was an eye doctor, right? You know, you get the stuff in your eye, so they open your eye. They put you in a separate room down the other end waiting for the doctor. And I'm going over all the diplomas and all the certifications from the doctors. And I found this, and I don't know if you can see it, but one of the certifications of the doctor, look at the signatures on that.
Looks like the good housekeeping seal of...
I'm thinking of that, knowing we're getting ready to do this episode and the respect that I have for ASC. And I said, wouldn't it be neat someday that we can have, you know, a certificate up on the wall that we have today, but it has 10 times more meaning to the consumer, to our client.
Yeah, that would be unbelievable.
With that said, I'm going to give you all last opportunity to just say something to our great listeners. Thank to our listeners for being here. Hopefully you learned something. Thank you so much for being here and listening. Any ideas or topics that you want, as Matt always tells his audience and I tell mine, please let us know. We're easy to get in touch. I think this was an episode that got the industry to learn more about distractors and question debates and wordsmithing and tweaking. And Scott Mann's great quote, every test is an opportunity for education. I love that, by the way, Scott, that was great. So let's go around the room. We'll do Brian, Scott, and Matt. Brian, any final word?
I just hope people really realize that these questions aren't written by people in ivory towers. And this is an organization that has professionals writing questions, oftentimes your peers in the field, in the industry, writing questions in order to separate the people who don't have the knowledge for that credential from the people who do have the knowledge for that credential. Although maybe they don't get it perfect every time, they're constantly pushing in that direction.
Thank you. Are you going to go to the eclipse on the 8th?
I have a campsite booked at Four Mile Creek State Park over by Fort Niagara, and I just heard... We do some work for the chief deputy sheriff here, and he told me they're expecting 500,000 people. So now I'm thinking maybe I'll stay home because I don't really like people that much.
This morning at our independent group meeting, we had an eclipse expert.
I read the notes. Paul sent me the notes.
He works for the museum. He is literally certified in eclipses, whatever. I bought the special glasses. He says, now listen, you could buy them online, but you need to test them to be sure that they're real. He says, but I have the real ones. So I bought the real ones. It's like a 15 welding mask, like 15. You can't use a new welding mask that they changed the filtration. And he was telling us 800,000, Brian, 800. Every hotel room in Western New York is booked and shops are closing because people are going to be pulling on the sides of the roads to watch this for those 3.5 minutes. But what I didn't think about, and I know we're talking eclipse, was if we don't have good weather, that entire group of people are all going to go somewhere as a herd, if you will. It's a swarm, and you'll never get anywhere for 24 hours.
I can promise you I'll be sitting in my camp chair eating ribs no matter what the weather is. I won't be chasing anything. That is for sure. If you see me running, there's big problems.
Yeah, we Ground Zero is like about 10 miles from where Tracy lives. The path is going to go right over it. Anyway, enough with the eclipse. Scott, any final words, sir?
I'd have to second what Brian said just about, you know, the test takers not beating this up. If I could just, you know, use one word, it would be embrace. You know, if you think about what ASE is meant to benefit, it's the shop owner, the consumer, and of course, the technician. And all three of those areas need to embrace this. It's kind of heartbreaking to hear that it's been around for so long, but you know, you said at the beginning of this that ASE is going to launch a new initiative to make people more aware of this. It's a shame that the industry as a whole has taken so long and has had so much difficulty embracing voluntary certification and the importance of it. Both, you know, shop owners have to embrace it to compensate technicians who go that extra mile to get it. The shop owner has to promote it to the consumer, and the consumers have to embrace it and understand that they need people that are capable of passing these tests and that these tests should be at a high level. to work on these unbelievable machines that they are piloting down the road. So, it's just really, if the industry can embrace it and promote it properly, it's certainly a great thing. And I think ASE does a great, great job.
Stuff, great stuff. Matt, you got the last word.
I guess I got a couple things to say. One is to us, and I think it's been repeated and bears repeating, though, it's ASE was created to help assure the motoring public that we were competent and keep the government out. And what do? After a few years, we kind of devalue it, which it's so counterintuitive. I mean, I can't even put into words the frustration with that. What do? We devalue it. Try to find every little hole rather than support it. And then if it needs to be made better, help it become better. No, let's just crap on it. The other thing is for ASE and the new president, Dave, if he's listening, subject matter experts, the workshops used to be live in person. We would go either around the country to different venues, usually, hotels, but we would be in person. So I would be able to sit next to Brian Pollack or across the room from Scott Manna. And more importantly than that is during the breaks, during lunch, in the evenings at the hotel, we're networking, we're getting to know each other, we're forming bonds and working on these exams, working on these questions deep into the night. There's many nights, workshops live in person where me and a select few others, not select, it's whoever decided they wanted to hang out till 2-3 in the morning, working on a question. We don't get that now online. And I understand the economics behind that. Like, it'd be nice for them to mix it up a little bit and bring it back, partially at least, that we do have live in person and where ASE does treat a subject matter expert like, hey, this is a pretty honorable thing you're doing. And we really appreciate that and kind of cultivating that bonding and that networking. I think that made the workshop stronger, made the subject matter experts stronger. So I hope that we can plead to start bringing that back a little bit. Maybe you can't all the way. Maybe we still got to do some online stuff because online favors a lot of people. They can't get away from the shop for 4 days or the better part of a week. So now they can do a morning online. I get it. But there's a lot to be said about live in person. A lot. So well said, bring that back.
Couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah, well said, Matt. And I think every time we look at the change like you just discussed and we kind of blame it on COVID, I think the history books are going to show an immense amount of loss that we had in intimacy because of COVID in such a big way. And when things weren't working quite right, we blamed it on COVID. We never tried hard enough to do the things that we know were the right way. My little soapbox here, but I hear and I feel what you're saying. Matt Foslow, shop manager and technology specialist at Riverside Automotive, Red Wing, Minnesota, trainer and podcast host of Diagnosing the Aftermarket A to Z. Brian Pollack, who lives in our town, just a little north of me, lead technology specialist at Wilco Auto Care, Sanborn and Lockport, New York. And our great friend, Scott Manna, who you have your fan club president here. That's so nice. Former shop owner, trainer, and AC Delco technician of the millennium. Thank you all so much for being here, guys. Thanks.
Thanks for being on board to listen and learn from the premier automotive aftermarket podcast. Until next time.